Yeah, we're discussing two related issues, although they are distinct. Two prohibitions with regard to one's relationship towards fellow human being, fellow Jews specifically, in this case. One is the prohibition against hatred, and that's referred to as the hatred of the heart. Thou shalt not hate your brother or your sister, however you like to translate it, in your heart. That's one issue. We have to define what exactly is meant by hatred of the heart. And of course, what situations we're talking about. And also, the inevitable question will be, well, how are you supposed to deal with it? Since hatred, in many, many situations, seems to be a natural or normal reaction. That's one of the issues. The other issue, which is related, is that it's a prohibition to take revenge against a fellow Jew, and even if you don't take revenge, there's this situation that the Rambam describes is one in which you're not taking revenge, but you're sort of harboring a grudge. And harboring a grudge seems to be similar to hatred, but it's not. It's not identical. It can incorporate. The case where it is prohibited to take revenge, the case of what the Torah calls revenge is interesting, curious, because the average individual would not regard it as such. It seems to be a type of behavior in which you treat somebody pretty much the way they treat you. And while a person might say, maybe it's petty, maybe it's not the highest level, but most people, I don't think, would consider it to be immoral or unethical. And that is the case the Rambam gives, where you ask somebody for a favor or to borrow an object, and the person refuses. Then, subsequent to that, that other person comes to you for something similar, wants to borrow the same object or something similar, it doesn't really matter. And you then treat that person the way they treated you. And you say to that person that I'm not going to lend it to you, just like you didn't lend it to me. That is a violation of lo tikum. It's considered to be taking revenge, exacting revenge against that person. It seems to be something which is perhaps a bit petty, although not everybody would agree, depending upon what the issue is. But people can identify with the underlying feeling, the underlying emotion. We should consider the fact that you will be affected by how significant you view the thing. If the less significant the favor, the more the average person will be inclined to overlook it and not exact revenge. The more significant, let's say you wanted to borrow somebody's car, that's considered to be more of a request, more of a favor. Then, when that person comes to you, the reluctance to overlook and let the person have the car will be much greater. Why is this considered to be revenge? Why isn't it simply pettiness or a violation of the fact that you should be helpful to somebody, and being helpful to somebody else should not really be dependent upon what that person did? That's how most people would explain it. Most people would say that you shouldn't do it that way, because really, what do you care how this person acts? You should just act the correct way. That's how most people would explain this. But that's not what the Rambam is saying. It's being suggested that this is revenge. The assumption is that we're talking about a favor or an object that you otherwise would have given to the person. And you're not giving it to the person because that person refused to give it to you. Thus, you are trying to harm the person. You're trying to deprive the person either of the object and also emotionally of the satisfaction that the person would get as a result of getting the object. So therefore, you're trying to pay back. You're trying to inflict some type of a restitution on the person for what they did to you. That is called revenge. And it doesn't make any difference that it's proportionate and that it may be justice. Rabbi Chay one time explained that it's justice. But you are not given permission to exact that kind of justice. That's not your job in this world. That's up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's up to God. Thus, you are not permitted to act in kind. The question is, what's the reason? What is the underlying basis for this prohibition? Assuming that every law of the Torah is leading us towards a certain perfection and removing us from a certain imperfection, what would be the imperfection of acting the other way, of acting in accordance with the general attitude of people, the way of the world, so to speak, to sort of deal with people, to treat them as they treat me, in a general kind of a way? On a certain level, I think that most people do employ that principle. That is, I'll treat you how you treat me. Maybe not exactly. Perhaps you're very harsh. I'm not going to be that harsh, but pretty much in that ballpark. What's interesting about the Rambam's explanation is that it's not in line with what most people would expect. Most people would expect the kind of explanation is that why should you base your behavior on what somebody else does? That is to say, if somebody else has a defect, then why should you act in a defective manner? Which makes a lot of sense. Because if you were to ask the person, well, why are you taking revenge? Why are you doing that? It's just that because that person was mean-spirited. So then you say, well, what's your evaluation of mean-spiritedness? Oh, that's wrong. Oh, so that person acted wrongly. And in a manner which is harmful to their soul. Oh, so now what are you doing? You recognize that as a defect. And you proceed to inflict the same type of damage on your own self. Doesn't make any sense. It's completely illogical and self-defeating. What you're saying is, because that person is sick and acted in a deranged way, so I'm going to do the same thing to myself. It's not a self-serving, and it is a self-contradicting form of behavior. That's a very strong argument. It's interesting that the Rambam does not seem to be saying that. It seems, in my mind, very akin to another popular argument that doesn't stand up under reason, that people use to justify certain behaviors. Let's be honest. When there are certain types of behaviors that are borderline, let's put it that way, or seem to be on the borderline, that aren't that egregious, there are certain things that people are not going to do regardless. Things that you regard as being absolutely evil, terrible things, even if they should become more prevalent and become acceptable, you're not going to engage in them. There are, however, certain types of things, perhaps in business and other things, where, technically speaking, if you're really fastidious, it's wrong. You'll have to acknowledge. But when it becomes very popular or prevalent, you'll hear people saying, well, you know, everybody does it. It's being pointed out that in Nazi Germany, this was the case, that when Hitler first came to power, it was only a minority of Germans that were involved in anti-Semitism. Many people disapproved. But as it became more popular, it became more acceptable, and many other people who, under different circumstances, would have behaved differently, began to engage, and it became okay, acceptable. Why? Because everybody's doing it. And that was the defense that many of the criminals used afterwards. That's, everybody did it. But there were certain people, a minority of people, that refused to go along with the crowd even then, and didn't engage in that or even help the Jews. That I assume is what they call moral relativism, or the ethics of relativism, that the standards of the community, something along those lines, community standards. It's interesting, there are many people that use that approach today with regard to certain forms of sexual behavior. Homosexuality and things of that sort, or abortion, things of that sort. Things that were clearly condemned years ago. Now, it's sort of like it's acceptable because everybody does it, and it's normal. It goes by the times. If more people do it, then it becomes acceptable. It's not an absolute in its own right. That's a very significant thing, that a person that's concerned about perfection has to free themselves of that element within them which enables them to justify behaviors on the basis of what people do. Deep down, that shows that the person's frame of reality is not God. The frame of reality is people. And if something will get the condemnation of mankind, then it becomes a problem. But something will not get that condemnation, then they have a completely different attitude towards it, and they don't feel the same type of guilt. That's a very serious problem. It's being further said that these very same people, their attitude would change depending on what the social attitude was. That is, when the Germans were in power, they didn't feel guilty about not helping the Jews. However, afterwards, when the Americans came, then they began to feel guilty. So that's a person that's living purely in terms of a reaction to the prevailing system. That's not a level of morality at all. That's an animalistic kind of, it's an instinctual phenomenon. It's pretty much like animals, a dog that's trained and breaks the training or something like that, and the master catches the dog, so the dog too will cower, so to speak. Even dogs have that type of a fear. It's not really conscience, it's a conscience which is pretty much rooted in fear of being discovered. The fear of condemnation. Most people in the world, their morality is not an absolute. It's pretty much of a reaction to the prevailing social conscience. However, there will be individuals who will operate according to, I guess we'd call it an absolute, a moral absolute. And, well, it depends. I mean, it could be because a person is really perfected and is using the mind and is absolutely committed to these principles in a true sense. Or sometimes you'll find it among religious people. Of not necessarily Judaism, of any religion, where the idea, the ideal, is established in accordance with something which is very compelling to the superego. Sometimes a person who is sincerely religious, whether the religion is a true religion or not a true religion, will behave in a manner which is absolute, regardless of what people are saying, because they have a certain fear. If the person believes that this behavior will get you into heaven and the other behavior will get you into hell, if that's real enough for them in terms of their belief, so then that will enable them to withstand any kind of pressure, because that's, for them, that's the reality. And I venture to say that many of the Christians who helped Jews during World War II, because in their religious framework, this was the absolute. This was to act otherwise, to hurt the Jews in their framework would have meant that they would lose everything. So they acted in accordance with that framework. The Rambam is saying that the reason why a person shouldn't act this way, shouldn't take revenge, it's a strange kind of a reason. It's something that's completely unexpected. I don't think if you ask anybody, they would come up with this reason on their own. He says it is fitting for a person to relinquish their own just demands. Which, by saying that, he's telling you that it's not unreasonable. This person refused to do something to you, it's not unreasonable to say that I'll treat you the same way. But no, a person should relinquish that. Because everything, in the sight of the people of discernment, is really vanity and emptiness. And it's just not worth it to take revenge over it. One of the problems with this Rambam is that we could see that in certain cases. There are cases where it's pretty petty and it's not worth it. But most people would say there are many other cases where the issue is not petty and it's very significant. A good question is being raised, and that is that on the surface, at least, it would seem contrary to a significant section of halacha, that is, to pursue justice in cases of business transactions, losses, damages. There's many tractates of the Talmud that take up all of these issues in very minute detail, all based upon the idea of justice, which entails restitution, paying damages, and so on and so forth. And the assumption is that if, in order to have an orderly society, people have to be held responsible, and people have to pay for the damage that they are responsible for. And it's not even a case where it's always intentional. Damages that is caused by man, by Adam, by the human being, you're responsible for. Because it's, the Gemara says that Adam mu'ud li'olam, that a human being is always prone to do damage. This, animals are rated differently. Some animals, the damage assessment would be less because it's called a tam. It's not the, there's no assumption that it's going to harm anybody. So it's more of an accident and less the fault of the owner. As opposed to an ox, which an ox is has to be guarded carefully because it's prone to gore. And man is considered always prone to do damage. And if you're in a place, well, I'm not talking about the public square, the laws are different there because you have a right to walk there, but when you're in somebody else's domain, if you're in somebody's store, you knock something off a shelf and you didn't do it intentionally, so, well, I'm not passing in a particular, in general, you're responsible. This goes contrary to American law, I believe. In most stores, when these things happen, they just, a supermarket, they'll just call somebody and clean up the mess, and they're not going to charge you for it. Although there are stores where you're dealing with more antiques, you know, more expensive items, where they don't want you touching it, and unless you're going to buy it, and they sort of have these signs, if you break it, then you take it, something like that, you know, you pay for it. But there again, it's because of the specific nature of the object. It's not the general rule. It's not based on a general rule. And there again, in the case of a supermarket, the reasoning behind it is not based upon what's considered just or unjust. They're not going to come and ask you questions to find out whether you were negligent or not. It's a matter of policy. It's not worth their while. These things happen, and it's not worth it for customer relations to make an issue out of something, so they just write it off. Thus, the question is that the Torah wants us to live according to justice. That's the assumption, that people have a right to regain what was taken from them and go to the Besdin. You're mechuyev to go to the Besdin, you're obligated to go to the Besdin, you're not supposed to go to a court of law because you're supposed to operate in accordance with halacha. But I don't think that anybody would give you an argument for seeking justice. In order to understand what the Rambam is saying, I mentioned before that there are certain things that the average individual would recognize as being so trivial that he wouldn't really be inclined to take revenge. If you ask the person to lend you a rubber band or something like that, something which is really, really trivial, but for whatever the case is, you need one. Yeah, this is where you need one. But the thing is really nothing of significance. And the person wouldn't give it to you. I doubt that in that case you'd hold a grudge or feel that then you would, the next day the person needs something similar. A paper clip, you'd probably give it to the person. Well, you might feel a certain pang, even there, you could feel a certain pang. There is an element in a person where you realize that something is petty, and when you realize that something is petty, then you'll say, this person is really sick. Okay. This person has a sickness, so I'm not going to take revenge. I'll give it to the person. Okay. And you would have a tough time not doing so, because then you would feel like you're so petty.
Right.
What the Rambam is saying is that in a sense, really, a wise person would look at everything that way.
Right.
Would never get overwhelmed by the physical.
Right.
What he's telling us is that the impulse to take revenge, is related to this overestimation of the physical. And not to say that all physical things are equal, and not to say that physical things don't have importance, that can't be said. That goes contrary to many things we learned. That Chazal say that the money of the Chacham is chaved, is beloved to them, just like their lives. So the monetary aspect of life is extremely significant. And then Kamach ain't Torah. If there's no flour, there's no Torah. That is true. But that's a realistic assessment of the value of the physical things in the whole scheme. But what impels an individual to want to get even with the person is not a realistic assessment, but a certain emotional overestimation of the physical. And because you feel that this is very, very important, so then you feel that this person really hurt you, and you can't tolerate the fact that he hurt you, and therefore you feel that it's quite justified. When a person takes revenge, they do feel a very strong sense of entitlement, that this person is bad, this person is terrible, and it's only right to treat that person. But that only comes into the picture when you're past the level of things which you would pretty much regard as petty. You see, it's two different emotions. In one case, the taking of revenge, you would feel that you're being very, very petty. And you wouldn't really enjoy the feeling. Because you would feel this person's really petty. And I don't want to be on that level. It would make you feel ashamed of yourself. On the other hand, when you get past a certain level, and you get to the arena of objects or favors which you would attach significance to, then the emotion changes, and to the contrary, now you must take revenge. Because this person really hurt you. But that idea that the person hurt you is based upon an overestimation of the physical. If you had things in perspective, if you had the correct philosophy of life, and you realize what the true good is, and what a person should really strive for, and the importance of the physical was measured by you only in relation to how it enables you to achieve the true good, but your real focus is on the true good, then everything would be petty. In that sense. And you would not have the impulse to take revenge. From that standpoint, there's a tremendous difference between how the Chacham looks at the physical things and how the ordinary person looks at the physical things. The ordinary person assigns great value to the physical things of this world. For most people, that's their real focus. Their whole focus is this world, and their whole focus is the physical achievements in this world. And as the object becomes more significant, greater energy is invested. But to the wise person, he says, to the wise person, everything in the physical world is pretty much the same. He recognizes that it can't have too much value in and of itself, because it's temporal. It's temporary. It's here today, gone tomorrow. It doesn't partake of the real. It's not the real thing. He can't get overwhelmed. And by the way, that is really the greatest protection against temptation and sin, which stems from temptation. Temptation is always accompanied by the feeling that this is it. I got to have this. What causes a person to engage in serious sins, averos, prohibited things, like adultery and other things like that, when the person knows that it's wrong, is an overestimation of this world. It's an overestimation of the pleasures of this world. A true chacham, a true wise person, just has a whole different attitude. Doesn't mean the person can't be tempted. You're a human being. And in different situations, different places, everybody will experience an emotion of temptation. But after experiencing the emotion, the question is, how do you resolve the issue? What does the person do? Now, many people move on to the next step. I gotta have it. If I feel this way about it, I gotta have it. And then you become obsessed with it, and you'll do everything to get it. That's a disease of the soul. The wise person, after the initial feeling dies down, begins to think about it, and in the scheme of things, it's not that important. If I do have it, I have it. I don't have it. That's a whole different attitude, because Once he thinks about it, he can't assign too much importance to something which is basically ephemeral. It's here today, it's gone tomorrow. It doesn't partake of true existence. It doesn't partake of eternity. This fits in with the point that was suggested before, that it's also true that in experiencing this, in the impulse of revenge, it is based upon the fact that something happened to me. Taking yourself very seriously. You were hurt. How could a person do this to you? The inability to look at yourself also, in the scheme of things, your own particular existence in the scheme of things is not that big a deal. It's not that important from the standpoint of the universe. That is true, that a person overestimates the significance of their own ego. And the inability to let go of that, not to personalize it, and also not to allow yourself to be affected by how that person acts towards you. All these things are incorporated in this. So you're allowing yourself to be sucked into the framework of the other person. Whereas you should look at the situation objectively. Why are you taking it personally? You're taking it personally as some kind of a blow to your ego. It's a rejection of you. There is definitely a narcissistic wound over here. All these things are definitely part of it. That is to say that you should really not be affected by the fact that this person gave you something or withheld something from you. All these things are true. That there's a very strong egotistical motivation here. A person feels offended personally. It's the ego which can't tolerate it. The Rambam doesn't focus on that aspect. All of these things, however, are rooted in the overestimation of this world, of the physical aspect. That's the source. And all the other problems stem from that. And if a person had a true sense of value, knew how to evaluate things, what's really important and what's not important, or what's of secondary importance, and where your energy should be directed, then these types of things would lose their significance altogether. Even the ego thing only bothers you because you feel that you were hurt. Why were you hurt? Because something of importance was deprived. But when you realize that nothing really of any importance transpired, so then there's no ego blow. All these things are rooted in the overestimation of the physical. Another question is being raised as to why the Rambam sees fit to give you this explanation as part of the presentation of the halacha itself, which the Rambam does not always do. There are many times where the Rambam just tells you what the laws are, then at the end of a section he'll give a little philosophical explanation of a general kind. But here he sees fit to tell you the reason. I'm just tossing out a thought over here. This is a very unique kind of a law, as we've seen. It goes contrary to ordinary human feeling. And on a certain level, the idea of treating people the way they treat you seems to make sense. But it's also strange. There's something which is strange about the reason that he gives, which is that it's really based upon a very high philosophical ideal. It's based upon a level that most people, it would seem, are not on. For example, when thou shalt not murder, you're not going to murder. That doesn't presuppose any great perfection in a person. That's something which is expected. A normal individual who understands that you have to live in a society and other people have rights and so forth, recognizes that it's the wrong thing to do. The fact that a person lived this whole life and didn't commit a murder would not indicate that he's self-affected. He's able to control himself. It's a basic requirement. What I find unusual about this law, according to the explanation, is that how many people are on that level? How many people are on the level where they really look at all the things in the world as being of no divrei hevel vavai? Therefore, this particular halacha, this particular law, is based upon the idea that people have to control their behavior, have to direct their behavior, gauge it on the basis of a ethical, philosophical absolute in terms of perfection. That's why it would seem that it's essential to understanding the halacha itself. If you don't have this point, then you can't understand the halacha. Now, I'm not raising the question, what about people that are not on that level? That's a different idea. You may not be on the level of the underlying reason. Philosophically, you may not be on that level. But the law demands that you recognize that principle and gauge your actions in accordance with that principle. So that's not a question. Because one could have asked and said, well, how many people are on this level? The overwhelming majority of people are not on this level. So is it okay for them to act? No. We all have to abide by this practical behavior. But you have to know the reason. Because the reason is an integral component of the law. In other cases, it may not be necessary to always mention the particular reason. Because it's something which is understandable. Not to hate, and so on and so forth. Certainly when it comes to not to steal, not to kill, not to insult people. Everybody could sense that you're just hurting somebody. But over here, it's contrary to ordinary human reasoning. As I said, it's hard to imagine any religion or any system that people live by which would incorporate this as a law and say that if you treated the other person the way they treated you, so then you're in violation of a commandment. That is something which you'll only find in Judaism. To answer the question, that is, that in general, the Torah is very, very demanding, very rigorous about this aspect of justice, monetary payments, restitution, even on small amounts. That is, it's mentioned that in terms of the any type of corruption in the court system, it's mentioned in the Torah that whether the matter be a big thing or a small thing, and it's equal justice. You can't say, well, it's just a case involving $10, so I don't have to be that precise. Can't say that. I would say that it's based on what I said before. There is a realistic value to money. We're not saying that the physical things in this world are of no value, and therefore you could just throw your things away or take what belongs to somebody else. That's not the case at all. To the contrary, you're supposed to be very careful with your money, take care of it. You're not supposed to be, even when it comes to giving tzedakah, to just give everything away. And therefore, in order to maintain a society in which people can live constructively and creatively, and the business should be able to prosper, you have to have an extensive system where each person's property is protected and it's respected, and that's the framework. That's within the realistic framework. There is a realistic framework. People can't live if they don't have their property. So when the issue, the nature of the abuse, is one which actually destroys your property, in the realistic framework, theft, damages, anything along those lines, cheating in business, so then you must have a system which redresses that. That's the realistic framework. That's the objective. You're supposed to be objective. You go to the court and discover the truth and restore things to where they belong. You must have that. This, however, is not in the realistic framework. This is not a matter where I'm stealing from you. This is in the realm of, let's say, favors, for example. That is, a person doesn't have the obligation to give you the object. He didn't steal anything from you. You didn't lose in terms of the realistic. You're talking in a different realm completely. Even if the situation was one in which the person had an obligation to lend you. As we said, there are cases where you have an obligation. It's like tzedakah, like charity. If a person needs a loan and you can afford it, and he asks you, and there's no reason not to, he's trustworthy, then you have an obligation. Even so, if the person didn't give you the loan, you would not have any right to retaliate, because that's his problem between him and God. If he fails to do it, the person really did not inflict any harm upon you in an objective manner, in an objective sense. You'll get someone else and get it from somebody else. That's not the area of damages. So if there's real damages, you have a right to restore it. And there's nothing wrong with that. Here, it's not real damages. It's imaginary damages. It's a completely different realm. Thus, in the realm of real damages, true damages, that's where the Torah gave a system to live by. A system of justice. And then you have to pursue justice. Because one of the objectives of the Torah is to eliminate real damages, real injustices in the world. That's part of the requirement of establishing a society which operates in a certain way, in a smooth, harmonious way. That's necessary. But then there's another realm of imaginary damage, imaginary harm, where the person has not stolen your property, has not inflicted any real damage upon you. It's a completely different realm. And you can't apply to it the criteria of justice. That's where the Torah said there is no need over here for justice at all. Now your response should be governed purely by considerations of truth. In terms of considerations of truth, you should recognize that nothing happened to you, and that there's no reason. There's nothing that's kedai for you now to take it upon yourself. What's the impetus? Why would you take it upon yourself to see to it that this person gets their just desserts? That's the question. Why? It would only be because you suffer from a certain defect, and you're far removed from the truth of existence. That's what the Rambam is saying. And that's why the reason is absolutely essential. Is that your thing in life? You go around perfecting everybody? Do you go around seeing to it that everybody should be in a state of justice? No, you don't. That's not your job. To answer the question that was raised before, it's not your job to go around and correct everybody's defects. So why are you now involved in correcting this person's defects? It can only be because you are suffering from a defect yourself. As a result of this person having a defect and acting upon it, it's sort of contagious. You're going to pick it up yourself. This is where, to the contrary, you don't seek justice. Because the entire motivation over here to seek justice is an imperfection in you. However, in other cases, where there's been actual damage, not imaginary damage, then you should seek justice. Then the motivation is reality, because of the realistic requirement of taking care of your property and seeing to it that you're not abused. There's a real abuse over there. And the motivation is to get what's yours back. That's it. It's not imaginary, and that's not a defect. It doesn't stem from a defect. To the contrary, it stems from something positive, which is that you want to live a life in which you are able to have the material resources that are necessary for the true purpose of what you want to achieve in this world. Now we're going to pick up on our discussion of the prohibition against hating a fellow Jew. So this is the Rambam, Ideos, chapter 6, where he says that whoever hates a Jew in his heart violates a negative command. So the key term in that formulation is in his heart. The Rambam goes on to elucidate that the Torah only warned us against the hatred of the heart. However, if he hits or degrades the one who offended him, even though it's not permitted, nevertheless, he has not violated the prohibition of hatred. Most people would say the opposite. that to strike back at the person, or to embarrass the person, verbally abuse the person, would be worse. This person, at least, is controlling himself, is not lashing out, but is storing it up in the heart. What the Rambam means to say is that even though in the case where he hits him or he degrades him, it's an action which expresses hatred. However, while that is wrong, it's not the appropriate way to deal with it. That's not the prohibition. The prohibition is not an action which expresses hatred. However, the prohibition is about maintaining a certain type of an attitude. The hatred of the heart means where you store it up in the heart, where you assume a new attitude of hatred towards that person. The hatred remains. The hatred is not dissipated. So there are two things that a person can do. There are two roads, so to speak, that a person can go down when somebody else offends you and it causes a lot of anger. The initial reaction is it's going to cause a certain pain or a certain anger. So one way is to strike back. In doing so, you may be hurting the person, but if you strike back at the person, that's it. You sort of even the score. And the assumption is, what the Rambam means, the assumption is that's it. So you got it out of your system. It doesn't bother you anymore. You cease to hate that person. The second case is where you don't strike back. So what happens with your hatred is that you internalize it. And it effectuates a attitude of hatred towards the other person. So the storing up, to be in a state of hatred of the heart, that's what the prohibition is talking about. The first question that we're asking is, simple question. What is the reason for the prohibition? Every mitzvah has a reason. Now, of course, one can say, in general terms, why hatred is no good for you, and it consumes your energy. That's a pretty popular notion these days. That, you don't get anywhere by hating, and you have to move on, and so on and so forth. But that's psychology, and maybe good advice. We want to know what the reason for the prohibition is. Is that what it is, or is there something more significant? Point is being made that it's not healthy from a psychological point of view. I would agree with that. I think psychologists would acknowledge that it is a negative emotion. Not in terms of the effects on the other person, necessarily, although that's possible, but on the one who has it. It's a very painful thing. It drains one's energy. It sort of brings you down. So it's unhealthy. It's unhealthy psychologically, and so therefore it could be unhealthy physically. That's true. But I think that's a byproduct. I don't think that's the prime reason. The Torah's system is geared towards human perfection. You have to answer the question in terms of the reasons of mitzvot in general, and the Torah is not, the mitzvot are not primarily for the sake of our health. That's something which we learn about through science. The Torah did not reveal a book about the protection of one's health. And that it left to human reason and science to discover. If we're going to persist in the approach of looking for the answer completely in the psychological realm, then you're opening up a Pandora's box, because there's many, many, many other things that are not healthy, beneficial psychologically, but the Torah didn't see fit to make a prohibition out of any and everything that from a psychological standpoint is negative. Example. A lot of psychological suffering comes from investing your energy in certain types of things, wishing for certain things to happen, putting a lot of trust in other people so you're disappointed. You experience a lot of pain, a lot of psychological suffering, because you open up yourself to other people. A lot of times you trust somebody else too much where it's not wise to do so. You open up to other people and then they may use that information against you. There's an endless amount of things that we could do which do not make sense necessarily psychologically, but the Torah didn't make legislation out of every one of these things. Even something like overeating, that's not good. In fact, the Rambam weighs against that and says that that's one of the main, he says, of all the Rambam held that nutrition is one of the most significant elements in health. And not so much He held that what you eat is important, the positive side, but avoidance of the negative. Bad eating habits were very destructive of one's health. The rabbi maintained that the bad eating habits is the most significant cause of disease, and that falls into two categories. One is eating the wrong foods, but by and large, above and beyond everything he said is overeating. Even if you're eating the proper food, overeating he held is a terrible, terrible thing. But there's no specific prohibition against that. There's no specific isser, prohibition, against the particular act of overeating, even though that behavior has serious connotations. It means to say that a person that indulges on a constant basis in things like overeating, in violating those things that are essential to health, and thus, as a result, is negating the whole area of maintaining one's health, which is a responsibility, so that person's in a state of violation. However, the particular act in and of itself does not constitute a violation. Because the Rambam didn't mean to say that if a person overeats occasionally, so then they're destroying their health. He meant that that is a significant factor. And thus, if a person is constantly indulging, living that way, it's going to have a negative impact. But he certainly didn't mean to say that the very act, if you do it once, you're destroying yourself. He didn't mean that. So therefore, in and of itself, that particular cannot be a subject of Isser. There's other reasons why it can't be a subject. Because in order to have a prohibition, it's got to be something that people can control. And it's very difficult, even people that control their diet, even people that watch what they eat, and do so in a general way, it's very difficult to imagine that a person from time to time is not going to indulge in the wrong foods, is not going to overeat. It just doesn't make sense. So therefore, when you legislate, you have to take into consideration whether the matter is fit for legislation. That's not the way to approach it. The issue of legislation is very significant. Legislation, prohibition, prohibiting something, is one tool, is one method by which the Torah seeks to lead a person to perfection. However, kedoshim to you, that there are certain things that just can't be legislated and other methods must be used. With regard to the decrees, gezeirot, prohibitive decrees that the rabbis have enacted to keep one far from sin, there too there are certain principles that govern them, and one of those principles is any law which the majority of the people can't maintain, it's too tough, and the majority of the community can't sustain, can't observe, must be rescinded. And if it's not, if they don't rescind it, it has no binding force. So that's another factor which has to come into the picture. Goes to show you that just because something is wrong, and just because you want people to stop doing something, does not necessarily mean that the path is to legislate, to make it prohibited. That has to be done with great wisdom, because a lot of harm can come from this. A person, you have to know the nature of people. And if it's the kind of a law that is simply too difficult, too painful, and most people can't uphold it, so then it's very bad that a law like that would be on the books. Because as a result of the fact that nobody will keep it, you're going to break down people's respect for the law in general. In other words, you're going to wind up losing a greater loss. You won't achieve the objective you wanted to, because they're not going to keep the law. And you'll sustain something which is harmful. That is, that people will, in general, now it'll be easier for them to break down the laws, because that's the way the psyche works. One violation leads to another. Because behind every violation is a certain conscience, there's a pang of conscience. So a person has a certain fear of the law, a certain awe. But once you start to violate and you adjust to that, that element within you which is inhibiting you from violation has become weakened. The weakening of the superego is what I call it. On a simple level, it's good to go back to the Rambam in the Mora on the section called the Divine Commandments. And the Rambam elucidates the position, which in the time of the classical commentators, the great Rishonim, maintained that virtually all of them held the same idea. And that is to say that all of the commandments have reasons. Reasons that are intelligible and constructive and beneficial in terms of human existence. The idea that the commandments are mystical and they're not subject to human scrutiny or investigation, but somehow or other they have all these mystical connotations. That idea is very popular today. People are drawn towards the mystical, and they try to project all types of mystical phenomena to the mitzvos. Mitzvos where the purpose is pretty obvious. We don't need to project, but people aren't satisfied with something that's rational and makes sense. They look for something which is mysterious. People are more attracted to the mysterious and the mystical. The Rambam says, of course, that all the commandments are rational, designed for the perfection of human existence. Of course, we know that there are certain commandments called chukim, and most people misinterpret that and think that now the chukim have no reason. We just do them. We just do them because God commanded them. That too is false. All the genuine authorities maintain that the chukim have reasons as well, but the reasons are not apparent to us. They're more hidden from view. And not everybody can discover them. The classic case, the ultimate case of the chok, where the reason for it is not obvious, would be the Parah Adumah. And it's attributed, Chazal attributed to Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, that he discovered the reasons for all of the commandments, except for the Parah Adumah. And only Moshe Rabbeinu knew the reason. But by that statement itself shows you that all the commandments have reasons, because he discovered the reasons. But why would you even search for the reasons if they weren't there? So the Torah is a system of ideas, of knowledge. It's rational concepts that are applicable to human existence. Now the Rambam breaks it down and says that all the mitzvahs of the Torah can fall into one of two categories. One category is the perfection of the soul. The individual, the soul, which consists in attainment of true ideas about reality, which are essential to the perfection of human existence. That's one category. The other one, he describes it as the perfection of the body. But when he says the perfection of the body, what he really means to say is that it's a system which is designed to enable man to satisfy his basic physical needs, his physical and psychological needs. And he says that that is of secondary significance, because given the nature of human existence, man is physical, he has needs, and it's impossible, as he says, to engage in his true purpose, to perfect the soul, if he's in a state of want, if he's in a state of illness. Now, in this category, all those laws of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, between man and man. So the Torah is broken down into two categories, between man and God, which essentially is just you. That which is beneficial to you. Correct ideas of God, not to idolatry, the prohibition against idolatry, eating kosher, praying, etc. That's all for the perfection of your personal existence. However, all the laws between man and his friend, Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, that is because man is a physical being. And man as a physical being can't live in isolation. So subsumed in this category are those laws which ensure the smooth functioning of a society. That's a very, very important thing, that there should be peace, that there should be shalom, and there should be good relations between man and his friend. Because only since we're all dependent upon each other, nobody can live in isolation. Human existence cannot take place in isolation. It's an impossibility. Man is a social being, social by nature. So one of the main goals of the law, L.A. with a capital, the Torah, is to achieve the perfection of society. Now the perfection of society is not an end in itself. In today's world, most idealists are focused completely on peace. That's the whole goal. The common good, the achievement of the social. And in fact, the whole war against Iraq, for example, that the justification on the basis of the fact that they were enslaved. Freedom, that these people, like all people, deserve to be free. So that you removed an evil situation, an evil society, dictatorship, and now you have freedom. And we would agree with that, that's true, that nobody has a right to enslave man. However, the only difference is that the average individual today would look at freedom, not that, assuming they have freedom, or assuming that they can establish a better alternative. They haven't done that yet. A democratic government in which people will be free. But that, we would say, is not the ultimate end. That's where we differ from contemporary American thinking. Contemporary American thinking would say that that's the ultimate end, that man should be in a state where he's absolutely free and do whatever he wants to do. Now, what he does with his freedom is, as long as he doesn't destroy anybody, as long as he doesn't destroy somebody else's freedom, that's we can't talk about it. That's the good. The good is to be in that state so you can just fulfill your whatever it is you're chasing after. We would not call that the ultimate good. Freedom is a necessary means to an end. And the freedom we spoke about on Pesach is the means, but the essential achievement in Yetzias Mitzrayim was the Geula, redemption. That is, to put us into a situation where we can achieve the true good. Those two have to come together. So, the way the Torah is established, one of the objectives is to create a social order which is best suited towards enabling people to function in a harmonious way. In summing up these ideas, I'm quoting now from the Morib, which would be page 314 in the paperback. He says, in some cases, the Torah contains a truth which is itself the only object of that law, as, for example, the truth of the unity, eternity, and incorporeality of God. That's in the first category. In other cases, that truth is only the means of securing the removal of injustice or the acquisition of good morals, such as the belief that God is angry with those who oppress their fellow men. As it is said, mine anger will be kindled, and I will slay. That's the idea of reward and punishment, that God will punish. That's necessary. That's necessary in order to assure a social order. Or the belief that God hears the crying of the oppressed and vexed to deliver them out of the hands of the oppressor and tyrant. As it is written, and it shall come to pass, when he will cry unto me, that I will hear, for I am gracious. So the Rambam is saying that's a truth, but the primary objective in communicating that truth is for the fact that it's very important to maintaining the proper social order. If there were no social order in which a person had to exist, so then this truth may not be that important. This being the case, that a significant objective of Torah is to maintain good relations in the society, and to prevent the breakdown of society. So one of the most significant things that does break down society, and it's true on virtually every level, it's a good lesson, it's not only the society as a whole, it's any organization, it's any unit, it's a family unit. Hatred is the destructive element. And what kind of hatred are we talking about? The storing up of hatred. The storing up of hatred leads to it's counterproductive to the objective of the unit, whatever unit it is, on the general societal level, the community, the shul, the family, the marriage. The hatred is something which goes contrary to the maintenance of the institution. That's why on the simple level, that's the reason why the Torah prohibits the hatred of the heart, because the hatred of the heart will lead to certain results which will have the effect of destroying the unit. That is therefore the basic reason, because it fits into the category of something which would be very destructive of the harmony and the social order. Because all things being equal, a person that stores up anger, eventually he's going to act it out. The question we have to ask now is, though, is that it's just a practical thing, but does it also reflect some type of a distortion? That is it that, where is the defect in the individual? Are we saying it's not really a defect in the individual, but you can't do it because it's going to lead to a certain result? Generally speaking, however, that which the Torah prohibited is wrong because of practical effects, but it's also reflective of a certain defect in the individual. But why? What's wrong with it? Now, it's being pointed out that if we analyze the development, the causes of hatred, it has a lot to do with the magnification of one's own ego. That the reason why you're so angry at this person, even though the person may not have done something that's of any real significance in the world, is because there's the magnification of the significance has to do with the fact that it hurt you. And this is easily proven, because people that are honest and people that keep track of their own emotions in an honest way, they're not involved in denial, will be able to see that they're not consistent, if they can bear to take that about themselves. They're not consistent in that very often you'll notice when somebody else is coming to you with a problem that they feel very, very upset about something. And then they'll tell you what it is. And generally, when you try and help them, what you're trying to show them, essentially, is that it really doesn't matter. It's not that big a deal. And it's kind of trivial, and they should overlook it. And even if the person was wrong, it's not significant. Now, did you ever notice that you had such an experience that you counseled somebody else very wisely, in general, to the effect that it's not of such big significance, you should get over it? And will it ever occur to you that sometimes the same thing happens to you? Maybe 2 weeks later the same thing happens to you and you're really angry. These situations can reverse themselves. You know, they have a tendency to do it in relationships. It could be 2 weeks later and you're complaining to a friend and the person points out, well, that's pretty much what you told me about and you were very philosophical about it. Did it ever occur to you when someone is talking to you and telling you over something that you were in the same situation yourself? And what you felt then is not what you're saying now. Two different worlds. There's an important lesson over here. And that is, you cannot be trapped by your own weaknesses either. Sometimes you'll see that parents will tend to be demanding on those things that they themselves lived up to in their own life. That is, when it comes to doing certain responsibilities or helping out and so on and so forth, they feel very confident about demanding that of their children, because when they were young, they fulfilled those responsibilities. But when a parent in their youth was lax, was irresponsible with certain things, sometimes they're very, very lenient in that area. They feel too guilty to impose such a high standard, because when they start imposing a high standard, they remember when they themselves didn't do it and they did the same kind of thing. So they feel very uncomfortable condemning or criticizing the child for that thing. They follow that emotion, which can be a dangerous thing, because if you follow that emotion, you're depriving the child of the kind of discipline that he ought to have. So when you're doing it, when you find yourself in that situation and your child has done something, and you remember how many times you did the exact same thing, but the situation requires that you give the child a lecture, you've got to put that emotion aside. And even if there's a little voice within you saying, you're a hypocrite, you did it, fine, be a hypocrite. That is not the point. The point is, your responsibility is to give the child what it needs right now, irrespective of what you did when you were young. Maybe you were crazy and you did that stupid thing, but so what? Don't let the child know that, because you're just going to encourage the child in that behavior. Hatred, no doubt, is a result of the magnification of one's own ego and an excess of concentration on the importance of the self in the scheme of things. It's a distortion. I would say in this case it is a emotional distortion. That is the defect. Just as we've learned that certain things are prohibited because it's an intellectual distortion, it's a false idea, Here, of course, it's based upon a false idea, but the emotion of anger is a distorted emotion. And part of our perfection is that our emotion should be in line with reality. That is, the perfection of Adam, of the human being, of course, has to do with truth. That is, a being that is in line with truth to the extent that we're capable of achieving the truth. But therefore, the emotions, our emotional reactions, since we're emotional beings, should be in line with reality. And that's a distorted individual is one whose emotions are completely distorted. They're out of shape and nothing to do with the reality of things. You see a person that overreacts to something which is insignificant. Tremendous reaction. That person is distorted. Distorted emotionally. It could be that person, in general, on an intellectual plane, is not distorted. It could be an intelligent person with correct ideas. But the carryover to the emotional arena, when it comes to the emotional arena, the person is totally distorted. So hatred is an emotional distortion. Because the kinds of cases we're talking about, there may be situations which call for hatred. That is against those people who really should be hated. The Torah doesn't rule out hatred. To the contrary. I think this confirms the point that there are situations where you're obligated to hate. The Rambam talks about people who are heretics, who deny God, who deny Torah. So the Rambam says that in that case, when they die, then the close relatives, instead of mourning, they have to get together and don their finest clothing and celebrate. Because that is an expression of hatred. But that's rooted in the love of God. And the Rambam quotes the pasuk, Halo Masanecha Ad Hashem Esna. That those who hate you, I hate. So you see that hatred is an appropriate response in certain situations. And the failure to hate the Russia would be an emotional defect. So the Torah is legislating, of course, in this case, it's the benefit of society, but that corresponds to a certain perfection or defect within the particular person. So the emotion of hatred in the types of cases we're going to be describing, where a person offended you, is an emotional defect. That is to say, a person should be able to get beyond it. Should not store up hatred. The Torah is not demanding that you don't experience the emotion. As we'll see, a truly perfected person in most of these cases would not even experience it. But what about people that are not so developed? The Torah is not demanding that you don't experience it. The Torah is demanding that you adopt a certain methodology which will enable you to get beyond it. That's all the Torah is demanding. Now we proceed to Halacha Vav. The Rambam says that when one person sins against his fellow, so that's the context of what we're talking about, the personal grievances, you should not bear hatred and be silent. As it says concerning the wicked, he cites the case of Avshalom, because Avshalom was offended, was aggrieved by the deed of Amnon. Indeed, it was a very serious thing. Because he had raped his sister Tamar. And then he had mistreated her. It wasn't just that. The seduction, the rape. But then he humiliated her by throwing her out. When Avshalom, who was her brother, heard about it, he was very angry at Amnon. And instead of confronting him, he chose to store up anger. And about 2 years later, when he had the right opportunity, he killed Amnon. So this has very, very serious consequences. That's why this is considered to be the derech of the Russia. The derech of the Russia, we can understand that, because it has to do with the magnification of ego. That he can't tolerate. He can't tolerate the idea that he suffers some type of a slight. Now, even though this was a serious situation over here, and it was a very serious sin that Amnon had committed, still, this didn't give him the right to use the avenue of storing up hatred. Doesn't mean he just should have accepted and forgiven him, as we'll soon see, there is a method. But you're not allowed to choose the method of hatred. There are many people that consciously choose that method. You'll see that they will take that. There are certain cases they're willing to talk it over and consider making up. There are certain cases where that's it. Nope, not after what he did. I will not. They reject the idea of renouncing the hatred. That when a person takes such a position, that is the not only is it an avera, is it a sin of thou shalt not hate, but the Rambam says it's the way of the rishayim, it's the way of the wicked. Which is very, very significant, because we don't say about every particular sin that a person sins that this is the way of the wicked. Here, by saying it's the way of the wicked, the Rambam is telling you that it's a very serious, grave defect. Just parenthetically, I've observed that there are people that in general like to have gripes. They go around with gripes. Some more, some less, but that is to say, they can't give up their gripes. And they can't give up certain angers that they have. Maybe towards their parents, maybe towards their spouses, to their children, towards life. So there is a certain aspect of the psyche. There are certain types of personalities that need to hold on to their anger. They can't let go, and they can't acknowledge that they're happy. They can't be happy. They have an innate need to have this reservoir of anger and complaint about something or other, how they've been treated. I don't think it's possible for a person to just automatically banish his gripes, but I think in general it's not a good thing. It partakes of this. It's related to what we're talking about. And a person should work on resolving them and removing them from the psyche to the greatest extent possible. However, the Rambam says, it's a mitzvah. Now a mitzvah comes into the picture. It's interesting. If somebody offended you, you now have a mitzvah. You can be put into a situation of prohibition, not due to your own action, but merely because of what somebody else did to you. It is a mitzvah to inform him and to say to him, why have you done such and such? Or why have you sinned against me in this matter? As it says, "Hocheach tocheach tamisecha," you shall rebuke. This is the mitzvah of rebuke. So this whole issue, when people offend, is a Torah issue, and it's framed by two commandments. One is the negative, you're not allowed to hate. The other is the positive, you're obligated to confront the person. When I say confront, I don't mean that one should confront the person in a negative or a hostile way. Which is just a descriptive term. One should engage in a dialogue with the person and question the person. Bring it to the person's attention and let the person know that you've been offended. That's okay. The Torah is not opposed to that at all. That's what you're supposed to do. As it says, then you shall rebuke. This is the mitzvah of rebuke. Then, if the person who offended you heard what you had to say, and acknowledged your point. If they acknowledged your point and sought mechila, sought forgiveness, the person apologized and requested your mechila, what comes next? What's your obligation? Your obligation is to forgive. You have an obligation to forgive. It's amazing. This is an area of life where everybody thinks they're permitted to make their own judgments. I'll go by how I feel. Everybody believes that that's the criteria. I'll decide whether I want to forgive you or not. I'll think it over. Where the Torah is saying you're obligated to forgive. Now you're going to be in a serious situation of the violation. If you refuse to forgive, so then it means you still hate. So you have to forgive. It sounds like a pretty cut and dried, simple kind of a matter according to the Torah. Below Yehiyah Mochel. Now we have the forgiver. The offended party. Now the Rambam says that the mochel, the one who was offended, now he calls him the mochel, the forgiver, should not be cruel, achzar. You see how very easy it is to switch from the position of being the offended party. A person feels certain rights because they've been offended, like a victim. But the victim can very easily become someone who's described as an achzar. And then he cites the proof, as it says, "Vayispalel Avraham Elohim Kim." And Avraham prayed to God. The case of Avraham is with Avimelech. When the Torah reports two cases where he was concerned that they would take Sarah, because Sarah was an exceedingly beautiful woman. And if they knew that Avraham was the husband, that they would kill Avraham. So he made up the story. So that wherever they would go, they would say that sister and brother. So this way, they wouldn't kill him. And that happened in Egypt, in Mitzrayim, and it also happened with Avimelech. In the case of Avimelech, he too took Sarah, and it's a hard story because he complains later on. He didn't know. He thought that he was permitted to take her. He didn't know that she was married. So God comes to him in a dream and warns him. God brought a plague upon him, physical suffering, a plague, and there was a message. There was a dream, prophetic dream, that he should restore her and go to Avraham and the request that Avraham should pray for you. So it wasn't that simple. It wasn't just a matter of restoring Sarah. That wasn't enough. He had to, if he wanted to get healed, he had to request that Avraham would pray. So Avraham prayed for him, but he followed Avraham. That's what he's citing. That when he went to Avraham and returned Sarah and make up, so Avraham prayed for him and God healed him. We're just discussing the citation of the Rambam. The Rambam cites the case of Avraham as an example of someone who was not cruel, who was forgiving. However, there's many difficulties with that. What exactly does that case prove? Why is that case necessary? However, when you look at that case, it seems that it's not clear who the victim is. Who's the offending party? Avimelech feels that he's the victim. Because when Avimelech first comes to Avraham, he criticizes, what did you do to me? How'd you put me in a position like this? So whose fault is it? He's angry at Avraham for what Avraham did. And Avraham gives him a few different reasons as to why he had no choice in the matter. But the main reason, as we said, is that he said there's no fear of God in this place. Then Avimelech seems to accept all this, and he makes compensation. He gives him gifts, and he invites him to live wherever he wants to live in the land, and then he tries to make up with Sarah, gives her a certain amount of money. And then it says that Avraham prayed. Now, if you want to cite an example of someone who really did not give in to the emotion to be angry, it does not seem at first glance that it would be Avraham, because after all is said and done, it seems that Avimelech acted with innocence. No one is saying that he knew that she was married. So that even if it was wrong on whatever level, maybe he should have looked into the matter more, it doesn't seem to be the kind of situation where you would bear a grudge. That is, there are different ways that people sin against you. Sometimes it's where they should have known better, or they had to, you know this, you should have known by now that this bothers me. You know, all different kinds of cases. But then there are cases where it's kind of inadvertent. These things happen too. You may come to a restaurant and you had a reservation and something, there was a mistake and you don't have it, whatever, and then they explain to you that the person who took the reservations left early and apparently they took the paper with them and whatever, so it's not against you. When you hear these kinds of things, the average person will tend to be less offended. Okay, it's not an offense against me. It was inadvertent. And this happens in all situations. Wherever you go, if you feel wronged, after hearing the explanation, it turns out that it was an accident. It was impersonal. Nobody knew. We had no way of knowing that this is what you wanted. When you hear that, the average person will take it into consideration. They still apologize. But you're not going to treat that as a case where, like, the attitude is, well, too bad. We don't care. This is how we do things. And too bad. That kind of thing. Then you're going to feel more offended. So it would seem that the case of Avimelech, where he didn't know, and he wasn't lying, he didn't know. that alone should be a very strong reason for Avram to forgive him. Why would Avram be angry at him? And therefore, the fact that he actually prayed for him, while, okay, it's a gesture of reconciliation, but why should that be the ultimate case of someone who really is not an achzar? It seems, at first glance, to be an easy one. Most people, superficially, would say, well, of course I would forgive in that case also. I also want to think about it. It helps. I found that it sometimes helps.